all over the world. So we should try our best to stem the tide of another war by releasing the force of spirit. It is quite possible to achieve this. Out of millions, even if 100 or 2 can develop the soul power through love for all beings, they can stop the coming of the world war. Because spiritual force, any day, is greater than material force. Even one man can work wonders by the spiritual force he develops. When hundreds join together for the great task, how can war take place? Many friends ask Ram Dass if another world war will break out. Ram Dass says it will not. Let us all firmly believe so and set free a peace wave to spread all over the world and to touch the hearts of all human beings and thereby create an atmosphere of harmony and goodwill. Even those who are responsible for war mentality will have their hearts changed. Ignorance is the cause of a crime. It does not deserve to be condemned, but it has to be removed. And by the power of your love, you can remove ignorance. If your heart is pure, from it will flow out love which can transform the worst of men into the best of men. One who is trying to harm others through lust for power will be disarmed of his evil intentions, and his heart will become pure and humble. This is how, by contact of saints, many people become good. We must become spiritual batteries, giving peace and joy to everybody. All of us have in us the all-powerful divine. All of us have in us the all-powerful divine. If only we are conscious of him and manifest his glory, then we can exercise that benign influence upon others. The power of the soul, God, is wonderful. We cannot adequately describe his greatness. When Ram Dass tries to express the inexpressible, he is struggling for words. It is said that God can only be experienced and not described. When we have him, we live in perennial joy and pour it out everywhere. By sacrificing ourselves for others, we find much more joy than by living a life of selfishness. The greatness of saints is fully revealed when they undergo persecution. We know that prominent saints of the world were subjected to persecution. As they were passing through the ordeal, their divine powers became more and more manifest. As a great poet says, lives of great men may be compared to leaves of aromatic plants. If you simply hold the leaves in your hand, they do not give out any fragrance. So it is with great souls. Through suffering, they do immense good to humanity. Thought I'd read to you part of what I'd written down when a saint there at the ashram, Tuli Baba, asked to see me. And so I came in, and there he was seated with some of his disciples and Carla and Lakshmi, who had come with me, sat down as well. Baba speaks only in Tamil. So we had a translator while I was there. Again, I noticed the sheen of Baba's skin. He has only the barest of loincloths. He has a round belly, mostly gray beard and hair. Hair is long and matted. He has a bushy eyebrows, a serious look most of the time, but he is quick to break into laughter. He carries a thinly made tube with holes only at each end. He looks at me occasionally, but mostly to the translator while speaking. I do the same. He began a series of questions. What is your spiritual practice? I had no prelude to this at all. He just simply launched into these questions. My answer, I practice Kriya Yoga and Ram Nam. I also serve God in the ways he directs me, and I love him more than the world and this body. What is your connection with this ashram? My guru, Mother Hamilton, met Papa, along with Mataji and Swami Satchidananda, on Papa's world tour in 1954. Mother was a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, who left the body in 1952. Mother felt that Papa would help her to her full realization. She and her husband sold all that they had, their house and all their belongings, and traveled here to an ashram in 1957. They stayed for about a year. How long have you been practicing Kriya Yoga? Since 1974, Mother initiated me into Kriya. I have practiced since. Also, on the first meeting with Mother, she sang Ram Nam. Kriya Yoga and Ram Nam I have practiced over 30 years now. Do you have any fears? I have not been aware of any fears since I spent a year in silence and solitude. What do you see when you look out on this world? Baba, you have come as Ram to give me an examination. I see God in all, in you, looking at those sitting around, and in the, you, and you, and you, and patting the wall next to me, in this wall. Do you see the God in the world, or as spirit? I see God primarily as the all-pervading spirit of God. I also see him in special manifestations of form as well. Do you ever experience fear? I'm not aware of having any fear. How do you feel when you see others suffering? And how do you react when others attack you, say bad things about you? When I see suffering of others, my heart hurts, and I feel waves of compassion. When others attack me, I first analyze myself to see if I have done something wrong. If I have done nothing improper, then I think, what state of mind the other person must have had to attack me. We have a word in the West, it is called projection. If someone is angry, they think the other fellow is the one who is angry. I try to understand the person attacking. If it is possible, I look for ways I might help them. My background is in counseling. If they are open to it, I try to help them. And then it was my turn. Swamiji, may I ask you a question? And he laughed. You may. You carry that thin metal pipe with you. Is that Krishna's flute? He answers, yes. I continue, does it also represent the spine, the Shushumna? Some surprise. And he says, it represents jnana. The pipe has no holes in the sides, only in the ends. That is why it represents jnana, wisdom, knowledge. If someone is ready, I hit them on the head two or three times. If it is your understanding, it is the Shushumna, and you let that go. Baba was leaving to do noon arati. He agreed to pictures. I kneeled next to him. He slapped me on the back as I had seen him do to others. It was not jarring at all. Rather, it was friendly. I turned a bit, and we held hands. Joy was in the air. I liked him very much. Baba has been coming to Anandashram for 7 days every month for some time. He is very friendly and familiar with Swami Satchidananda. As I rose and Baba was leaving, I pronamed to our translator. The devotee, much larger man than myself, with a great black beard and shining eyes, rushed across the room and gave me a great bear hug. What fun. When we walked away, Lakshmi wanted to say something very badly to me, but her English is halting. Baba said something about you, he said, what Baba was saying. He knows it in Tamil. He knows it all. Her face was beaming with joy. She pronamed at my feet. So that's a very, very interesting meeting. This man who's considered a great saint all across India. the darshan of saints, the darshan means the sight of, to be in the presence of, is a very great thing and cannot be underestimated. Papa oftentimes talks about the great boost that he received by having the darshan of saints as he traveled all over the India. When I went to India this last time, I didn't have any clear objective other than I felt God's inner prompting to go. But through our travels and being at Anandashram, I met several great saints, and the greatest that I consider of these is Swami Satchidananda. And although his body has been broken by a stroke, it is still emitting a powerful light. And for all those who are receptive in heart and soul, it has a transforming feature to it that is really something to be seen, to be believed. You have to experience it. You have to feel it. And it is such a great blessing to receive the grace of these saints. Another person may come and they just simply don't experience much. They don't feel much. They don't see what the specialness is of a particular soul. There are also other wonderful souls there, souls of high realization. Lingpa, who served Mother when she was there in 1957, and when she was going through these terrific experiences, only Lingpa would do. She would call out, "Lingpa, Lingpa," until he came. And he is at the ashram. The time before, 3 years ago, he would serve food, and he just has a sparkle in his eye and a wonderful look to him. And now he is cleaning the mandir and those kinds of activities, which in the hierarchy of the ashram is something higher than what he is doing before. But he is a wonderful soul. And there are so many wonderful souls there, so many great examples of universal love and service that Papa talked about. When we engage in universal love and service, we take the personal out of it. The human being engages his mind and says, well, this person has done something for me, and so I would like to do something for them. That's natural. Or we have some common interests, or we're friends, and so I would like to do something special for this person. But when you enter into the universal love and service, you break down the boundaries that personality starts to enforce upon you. And you feel that every person that you meet is part of your one universal family. And through that feeling of unity that comes with that spiritual awakening, you serve every person, you meet every person as if they are your own beloved. Now, in a human sense, as we go about the world, it's not that we fall down at the feet of every person that we meet. You will still feel strongly attracted to a particular individual and to do something for them and not for another person. And in the beginning, that troubled Mother Krishnabai, who had become imbued with Papa's teachings on universal love and service. And she would see where he would treat one person one way and another person another way. And it confused her mind. She wondered whether he could truly have the universal vision when he seemed to prefer to have the presence of one person and not another. And what she came to understand over time was that Papa was going according to God's will and how God directed him inside. And that from a human standpoint, it made sense for this one to get more attention and that other one less. And yet, the universal vision comes from seeing that it is God who is in every individual. The difference in making distinction comes from God's revelation through the mind that, yes, you should move in this direction and back away in this direction. You should do this now. And when you make a choice to do one thing, you are choosing not to do many, many other things. And yet the mind is always in union with universal consciousness. So the direction is perfect. It's not motivated by the ego. It is motivated by divine will. And that is the difference between operating out of a human sense, purely, of trying to serve people, and operating out of that universal sense. This is very important to understand, because the outward actions of an individual that is moving according to divine consciousness can appear to be operating in a normal human sense, that they have likes and dislikes, that they have preferences for this person and not for that person. The difference is, inwardly, the universally realized being is always going according to divine consciousness. And this is the goal for all of us, to transcend purely our own human likes and dislikes, to unify our mind, our consciousness, with the divine mind, with divine consciousness, to transcend those biases that come from a purely human standpoint, and go into that universal being. For it is in this that you will discover that universal vision is not just a intellectual concept or a nice idea. It is a living vision that guides and directs you in all your ways. You will find that bliss, that peace, that absolute knowledge that you and divine consciousness are one in the same. And it is the fulfillment of all human evolution. It was for this purpose that we are born upon this earth. And anything that does not help you towards that universal vision has to be dispensed with. Bhakti is the great upward urge for divine consciousness. Bhakti is that great love for God, for spirit, more than for the body, more than for the little self. Jnani is the weapon of the mind that can cut out those things that take you away from that universal vision, those things that interfere with your progress upon the path. And unless we have both in operation, both the bhakti and the jnani, then we cannot ascend into those highest realms. It is a tremendous path that is laid out before us, one that takes us directly to the goal. And if you grab it by the horn, so to speak, you go with it. You take the tools that are given to you, and you practice them without ceasing. They will take you directly towards your own universal vision. Now, in order to do that, you have to face yourself. But in facing yourself, you go beyond the things of the little self, because you overcome them. And once you overcome them, and you go into that higher state of being, then you become anchored in that. But this does not happen in a day. It doesn't happen overnight. When I first met Swami Satchidananda, I asked him, point blank, I said, "Are you universally realized?" And he said, "No." He said, "Papa had said that to be universally realized, to have Sahaja Samadhi, meant that your union with God was without effort, without effort." And that as a result, he found that he still needed to take effort to redirect his mind. He didn't say that, but I'm filling in the blanks there. And so here's a great practitioner, a great sadhaka. And I didn't ask him this last time that I was there, but I think I might, if I received an answer at all, I think I might receive a different answer. Because his manner of speaking has changed. It used to be, well, Papa would say this, Mataji would say that, and he quoted them a great deal. And now he speaks from his own truth, from his own realization. And he talks much less about Mataji and Papa because he has become absorbed in them. He has become one with them. He has transcended any sense of duality, any sense of differences. And he has moved into that universal consciousness. I have met some of the greatest saints that are living in India today. And I found in my own investigations that Swami Satchidananda ranks at the top of all of the ones that I've met. And it is a great, great privilege to bask in the presence of such ones. And whether they are operating perfectly in the body or not makes not one iota of difference. For those great souls, for those universally realized beings, it is not their body, because once a saint has attained that higher consciousness, then the body is free for them to use as they like. And there are many, many saints who simply drop the body. They simply leave it behind. It's no longer of concern to them, and they don't want anything to do with it, really. They want to move into that universal spirit without being bothered by having a body at all. So they leave the body behind, and they move into that universal freedom, peace, and bliss without interruption. But there are other great masters whose compassion reaches out for this world. Mother described this once, that she had a visionary experience, and she was up above this world, and she is looking out over it. And she knew that she had the choice to drop the body and to leave it behind. And it was a great temptation because, you know, this body is just simply a nest of troubles most of the time. It promises a lot, but it delivers on very little of it, huh? But she looked down on this world and she felt compassion for it. She felt love for it. She felt love for all those beings that she knew were struggling to realize God. And so she chose to come back into this world. And she actually had to struggle for some time to get her attention, to get her consciousness fully oriented back into the body, because there's a part of her that kept on wanting to escape into the universal bliss of pure spirit. And so she described that at the time that sometimes she would go to see a movie, a Danny Kaye movie or some comedy, something to try to focus her attention on this world. And in the meantime, this tremendous spiritual current was lifting her up, and she had to bring her mind back down until finally she could operate in this world just as anybody else could. And it was very interesting to watch her operate at times, because as I did, I could see that she met the person that she was speaking to exactly at the consciousness level that they were presenting. So she might be in a very high state of consciousness. And as that person kind of took her to task or asked some tough questions or something like that, her mind would shift and she would go down into that chakra level, into that consciousness level that person was coming. And she would meet them right where they came from, right where they lived. And yet for her, it did not represent a fall in consciousness, because her consciousness was always attuned to the highest divine. And she felt that these various states of mind, these various states of consciousness, were simply different avenues to operate through with the divine consciousness. For those of us who are struggling on the upward path, there are ceilings that come with these different states of consciousness. And we cannot transcend them. We cannot go beyond them. And that represents our Hades. That represents our hell, because we live in that sense of separation. But for a realized master like Mother, No such barrier exists. She can operate in that consciousness and yet retain her divine union. And so she could operate in a human body as any other human being could. And yet she carried with her that universal union, that divine union with the infinite within her. And so the meeting with these great saints in India is something that really is of a wonderful nature when we approach it in the right spirit, when we approach it with an openness for the upliftment, for the divine change, for the change in our very atomic structure, both subtle and overt. There are changes that occur that are beyond the mind that we're not even fully aware of at the time. But down through the years, those blessings continue to reverberate through us. When the ground has been properly tilled, suddenly the seed bursts forth with wonderful fruit and flowers and fragrance. It had been lying dormant, perhaps, in the ground for so many years. And then suddenly we realize the fruition of what had been sown so long ago. It is not that saints are relegated to India only or up in the Himalayan regions. That a saint can live in our life, that we can have a family member, that we can know an individual who has a wonderfully elevated consciousness. And if we open our eyes to that possibility, we can recognize that saints and sages may be living in our own life, and yet we've not thought about them that way. We've not given them the credit for which they have achieved, and they may not think of themselves that way. Many saints are oblivious to their own attainment. There is the story of Hanuman, and that Hanuman would become kind of amnesia to the great powers, to the great abilities that he would have when he focused his mind upon God, because he was so focused upon his ideal, which was Ram, that he would forget himself. And if some task were at hand, he'd be looking around with everybody else to see who might be able to do that task. And somebody would remind him and say, Hanuman, you have all of these tremendous abilities, this strength, this ability, these powers. And by that reminder, he would say, oh yes, that's right. And then he would be able to demonstrate them. But as soon as that task was over, he completely forgot himself again. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, to be lost in the common life. That doesn't mean that we become ordinary in our consciousness, but it does mean that as we attain that supreme consciousness, that we can be lost in the common life, that we can ride a bus just the same as anybody else rides a bus. We can walk the sidewalks. We can mingle with people and be a part of all humanity. It's a wonderful story. A man who, Babaji, he went to Lari Mahasya's, and this man was a Swami. He's a saint with two bodies that Master wrote about. And Lari Mahasya said, if you go out in the courtyard, you'll meet Babaji. I know that's something you've longed to do for a long time. So he went out, and here was this young Indian man dressed in a plain white dhoti, looking like innumerable other young men walking the streets. And he is quite surprised by this. He didn't have ochre on. He didn't have anything that would specially signify anything about him. And so Babaji, knowing his mind, said, which is better? He said, you wear the Swami clothing. Everybody wants something from you. He said, I can walk the streets and nobody even gives me a passing glance. You tell me which is better. You see, the one is predicated that if we wear special clothing, if we have a certain name, we'll get recognition from the world. Huh? We'll get a special status from others. But when you yourself are in divine union, and you find the fulfillment of all your dreams through having that divine consciousness, then what is it that you need from anybody else? You are just simply an expression, a manifestation of that divine consciousness. You feel the joy of movement or non-movement, of upliftment or not upliftment. It is all God. And there is nothing that you need from anyone else. And this is real freedom. But with that freedom doesn't come a indifference to the world. Rather, there is a loving compassion because you see yourself manifesting in all those whom you meet. And if there are those who want to grow spiritually, who want to take the effort to really do something with their lives, then your heart spontaneously flows out to that one. And you perhaps give them some of the tools, as Babaji gave us Kriya Yoga. You be the example, as Babaji was with Lari Mahasya, as he is washing the loda, the vessel, of a certain sadhu who was not very qualified. But here Babaji was just humbly serving him as an example to Lari Mahasya. Who are you to put yourself up on this high pedestal and look down on other people? And this was the great revelation that God gave to me at one time, that the great masters don't look down upon us, but they look out through our own eyes. They look out through our own experience. They know who we are intimately because they are that themselves. And yet they are more than that because, once again, they don't have any ceiling that keeps them limited. They are also that divine consciousness. And so they see our history. And they see our future. And they know that we too will rediscover who and what we truly are. And this is the great pilgrimage. Whether you ever leave your own home or not, it makes no difference. It is still your pilgrimage. And it is the pilgrimage that every single individual is embarking upon every single day, whether they are conscious of it or not. Because we are all in the business of growing, of evolving, of refining the consciousness. And many are experimenting with all the wrong ways. But in the end, all those wrong ways will only highlight what the true way, the real way, is for them. It is through the contrast of all these failed experiments that when they finally get the one that works, they will really know it. And there will be no doubt in their mind that they know it. So let us first embark upon our own pilgrimage. Let us first live every day in a pilgrimage. You know, there is no ordinary moments. It really is beyond my ability to fathom how anybody can experience boredom. Because life is so richly embedded within us and all around us. How can there be boredom in that? How can there be boredom within life? When you are in touch with your true purpose for being here, there cannot be boredom. One devotee, a Westerner, was saying when Swami Satchidananda, he was drawing on his writing board, and he tapped his fingers on it, and she says, "I think he's bored sitting there with all these people just kind of looking at him." I said, "You don't understand Swamiji's consciousness. What he was drawing on the board was the Hindi for Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram." It's impossible to be bored in that sense because the life energy is so flowing through you, even in the ordinary activities, that life is full. You are full and you feel complete, whole, one. And through that sense of wholeness and oneness, you are forever healed of those discords that once plagued the human personality and the ego. Everyone has a past. Everyone has a past. The past is not what is important. It is what we make of that today and tomorrow. The greatest saints oftentimes started out as the greatest sinners. Isn't it so? And then they were propelled like rockets towards the divine goal. So let us ever keep our mind upon God. Let us ever strive with everything in us, heart, mind, and soul, to achieve that divine union. I guarantee you, you will not regret it. Maybe in the upward path, sometimes we may regret it. But once we achieve the goal, we will never regret it. We brought some things from India today, and I have a kind of a slideshow on the computer that you can look at as well, pictures from India. So all these things are here, and we can have a chance to chat. I've added a cold, so I'll just give you pronouns today and maybe not give the hug, so I don't spread the good news of the cold. But be glad to talk with all of you. And it's so lovely to be here, to see you. Time is a funny thing. Each day that we are gone, it felt like one day could have been several days, or a week, or sometimes a month. So much was packed into a day. And then you return, and it seems like no time at all has passed. Just a blink of an eye. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence,
in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy
feet, and surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection,
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
It's on the little silver plate here. It's a marvelous experience going into that cave. And, 3 times now I've visited. And each time there's been a sense that when you enter into the cave, you enter into a sense of timelessness, that all eternity extends out from the deep quiet and very deep vibration, like something that comes from the center of the earth. We're going up to Babaji's cave. Before, we've had guides take us up there, probably as part of the little resistive forces. No guide was provided this time, and the path has actually changed some since we were there. They've done some different things up there. So every time we were at some decision point, do we go left or right, do we go up or down, somebody would show up. This is out in the middle of the forest someplace. And somebody would show up and say, "Oh, Babaji's cave," and they would point up to the right direction. One time we were taking the wrong direction, and some people were down probably 200, 300 yards, and they started, heard some screams, and then they were pointing another direction for us to go into. So Babaji took nice care of us to keep us on track. Found some nice goat trails to go up.
It's a good thing you didn't have a hankering for a cigarette. That's happened to Papa.
Yeah, Papa.
God might have provided.
Honor is not thrilled about heights, though, and we got taken along some little trails that had some steep drop-offs to them, but she managed all right.
How high is the cave? Is it around 6,000, 7,000 feet?
About 6,000 feet, I think.
And what's the topography? Is it like kind of nestled into a hill, or is it right at the peak of the hill?
Or? It's not at the peak. There are several steep ravines that come down that are rocky, but they have rhododendron trees, pine trees growing along the side of them. So you climb up into kind of a narrow valley, and it's fairly steep climbing at that point. And you come up to a ledge, and they've actually added some concrete there to make the ledge there and to make it more accessible. And the cave itself is made out of slabs of granite that are laid at angles with each other. So,
in which direction is it faced? Do you have a feel for that?
Let's see. I hadn't thought about that, but I think north. Because west would be coming up behind it, the sun does. So if it's not due north, it's a northerly direction.
So David, I don't know if you talked this or if you're up for talking, but you said that there was some sort of dark force that you met there, that you felt that was at least part of your purpose for being there. And has God told you to tell us about that?
Well, other than that, there's somebody there who is doing tantric practices. But it went beyond the individual. It felt there was some substrata of in that area that had taken hold, that represented oppositional forces. And I think that's it for now.
But all was well.
It got worked through. And when we went back, where before it had been just nothing but opposition, when we came back after several months, it just was a wonderful, pure feeling there. So it's confirmation that the change had happened and occurred there.
Did you go to the cave itself twice during your trip, or only once?
Just once.
Was the trip down to the Ganges related to the cleansing of the area?
It's definitely related to the cleansing of us after that experience. And so I think you'd have to say it's related to the cleansing of the area. We are still carrying a great deal of that darkness. Didn't penetrate to the inner layers, but we could feel it around us. And part of the both bathing in the Ganges and also just being next to it and feeling its spiritual currents was very cleansing and took all of that away. So by the time that we were up north of Rishikesh, that had been completely eliminated. The story with the Ganges is that Shiva was having an argument with Brahma, and he got so angry that he cut Brahma's head off. And then he found that it was one of Brahma's 10 heads, and he found that Brahma's head was stuck to his hand, and he couldn't get rid of it. And he wandered all over the universe looking for some way to get rid of this. And finally he came back to the Ganges and he took a bath in the Ganges and it released itself and he was cleansed of it. So that's one of the stories around the Ganges, that's purifying force that allows you to get rid of those things. Which I took all in, well, that's a nice story, and I certainly liked being by the Ganges before. It was fine. But I had not experienced its spiritual purifying force as I did in this last time. Now it's very much connected with that experience up at Torah Hut.
So, what's the difference between the outer resistances like that and your own inner resistance?
Well, they're connected. But it depends on if you're asking about the cause and effect. Some things happen as a result of world consciousness. It just simply is. You walk into a room and there's something dark there, there's something negative, and maybe that sticks with you for a while, or you watch some kind of movie or something and has disturbing images and you just can't get it out of your mind. That's not something you've necessarily created, but you become a part of it. And therefore, that's something that you have to deal with at that point. There are other things, then, that we've more actively helped to create
And then we draw those things back to us. And some experience comes into our life, and so it's more directly related to our own creation that we've given out at a different time. So there are times when God will have it so that we can participate in helping in the purifying and the upliftment of this world. And we encounter something that's not of our own creation, but we're put into the middle of it so that we can help that situation out. If you, say, have a friend who's having some difficulty and you're able to render your friend some assistance, and it takes a lot of work, perhaps, for you to offer that assistance, but you're able to do it and it makes their lives better. It's not something that you've necessarily created, but God's put you in the position to be able to be of some help in that situation. So there are things that come to us as a direct result of things that we've created. There are other things that come to us that are an opportunity to give this universal love and service.
But if this, somebody created this stuff, and you're the one that's fixing it, there's cause effect. If you do something wrong, you get the bad karma for it. Then they don't get it. How are they going to learn?
Well, perhaps they're in a position where they're wishing that this was gone, but they don't feel they have the power to make that happen. They find themselves, it's like the story Papa told of the man who made the deal with the devil. And the devil said, all right, as long as you keep me busy, then we're all right. But the moment you don't have anything for me to do, then I'm going to destroy you. The man thought, well, that's all right. I have no end to my desires. But after a lot of desires got fulfilled, he started getting worried that he couldn't think of anything. So he went to the saint, and saint said, all right, you keep the devil busy by going up and down the pole and solve the problem for him. At that point, even though he had created something like that, he didn't want the results of it, and he wanted some alleviation of it.
So that he did learn.
He did learn without having to face the full impact of what he had done. A very interesting life you enter into when you have this life in God. It takes you into many places you never knew that even existed sometimes. The difference is that you feel one with God. Those experiences, they may even be difficult to take in the body or even the mind, but there's an underlying feeling of unity with that divine presence at all times. And that's the difference.
I have a really difficult question for you.
I have a really difficult answer for you.
Person, does who you vote for have any reflection in your God realization?
Well, Mother oftentimes spoke about the human and the divine.
Uh-huh.
And from the divine perspective, all is God. All is God. But when you enter into the human realm of things, then you divide things up and you say, well, this is better than that, or this is preferential to this. And so that exists there. When you
feel your oneness with God, then God will guide you along certain lines. And you'll see things from a certain perspective. But you'll find that amongst God-realized individuals, they will have differences. Mother had differences of opinion from Master and also from Papa. Then fully admitted, these are differences that I had from them. And, well, is one right and the other one wrong? And you can say, well, that's how God expressed himself through each one. So, in our own making choices, whether it's around politicians or what to eat for dinner, you know, some people would say, well, unless you're a complete vegetarian, you can't be a spiritual person. And I've had people who have said that. That wasn't Mother's view, it wasn't Master's view. And Papa also gave allowances for that as well. Although vegetarianism was very much advocated both by Master and by Papa. Mother not so much so. And so will you say, well, is one right and the other one wrong then? And my view is that God is expressing himself through that individual for the people and the circumstances that are surrounding them. And that he will do it for their highest good. But that people of realization, it's one of the beautiful things in, say, our own guru lineage, and seeing quite different personalities. From, you know, Lari Mahasya is very different from Master. And Sri Yukteswar, they're quite strong personalities, all of them, but very different one from the other. And you begin to get the idea, it's not about being a certain personality. Rather, there's something deeper at work there that represents what a fully realized soul is. And so the main question is, how does God prompt you in the world of politics or in the world of making any choices at all around things? And how is there absolute truth? And you can say, absolutely, there is absolute truth. But you will not find that absolute truth in a relative world. That absolute truth goes beyond the relative world. And yet Masters will say, this is very definitely right, and this is very definitely wrong. But you also find that there are usually times when that doesn't hold, according to that Master. That other times it's appropriate for a certain thing to happen. So it's very difficult to get dogmatic then. And yet we have to, as a human self, we have to adhere to a code. We have to adhere to, whether it's Dharma or the Golden Rule or whatever is in our life, because the human ego has to be trained to attune itself to the spiritual vibration. So we both start out on a path. Mother had strong feelings about politics and things like that, but I never knew her to demand anybody else to share exactly the same thing. But she was more than willing to tell you, you know, if you enter into a conversation with her. And she had her reasons for doing that. But, you know, I think it was when she first went to Anandashram and they started drifting towards a political conversation. And you know, Papa steered it right back and said, that's not what we're here for. You know. We should remember what we're here for primarily. And that is to realize God. And what Papa was saying about finding that underlying unity, that will solve the world's problems. That doesn't mean everybody will join the same political party. It means that there's some deeper truth to be apprehended here. That will then inform all of your other decisions as you do that. But Masters will oftentimes say things that shock us. And
And many times that helps us to expand our worldview. We're certain that things look just a certain way and that they ought to look a certain way. And Master will come along and shock that worldview, because they want us to go beyond the mental only and to find that pure spiritual spring that inspires them in their life. I guess you could say that God is both a Republican and a Democrat. And an independent. Which you look for in politicians are people who have integrity and people who believe in what they, you know, what they espouse. Their actions and their words match. And then you can admire people, whatever aisle they sit on, side of the aisle they sit on. Shall we have potluck? Adios.